welcome to this series of lectures on the importance of religion. I get to speak for about 45 minutes, I suppose, perhaps 50 minutes, and then I hope we'll have some 15, 20 minutes of time for discussion. This work is very much in progress, so these aren't kind of my definitive or own thoughts on these matters, and it's really much still being formulated. So I'd be very interested in your feedback. The lecture that I'm going to give today, it's a fairly sort of formal presentation, so I'm going to read much of it, but I hope to finish early enough for us to discuss these issues and matters. So the aims of this lecture series then are really about the importance of religion, because religion is a fundamental, that religion is of such fundamental concern, can't be doubted, I don't think, as we move into the 21st century. And it's central to global politics, cultural and identity politics, ethics and socio-economic processes of late modernity, as well as the contested claims about truth, if you like, made in its name. But never, in my view, has religion been so misunderstood. Never has there been a time when the critical understanding of religion, as the kind that can be done in religious studies, been more important, and never has there been a greater need for such knowledge and critical understanding to inform public debate, which so often lacks informed perspectives. Now, some disparage religion as irrational, making claims about the world that simply can't be substantiated in the light of modern scientific knowledge. On this view, religion is a series of propositions about the world akin to scientific theories. So on that view, the history of religion is a history of error, really. So there's that view. Now, on the other hand, apologists for religion react to this critique, defending religion on rational grounds, that its claims are indeed compatible with modern science and scientific thinking. And we only need to look around the bookshops to see a proliferation of this kind of works, the critique of religion and its defence on propositional kind of grounds. Yet both critique and apologetic, in my view, have fundamentally misunderstood the nature and importance of religion in people's lives. I do not intend here to dwell on the rather endless debate about defining religion and the legitimacy of the category, whether it's constructed or whether it's a sui generis category. Cantwell Smith, years ago, encouraged us to abandon the term religion in favour of a distinction between cumulative tradition and inner piety or faith of the participants. And J.Z. Smith draws our attention to the problematic nature of the category and his remarks that, quote, there is no data for religion, and that religion, quote, is solely the creation of the scholar's study. I mean, he could be provocative in that. A more recent work has rejected the category religion as being of any use in analytical inquiry, and indeed has presented an understanding of the ways in which religion is embroiled in a web of power, economics and politics. On this view, religion is not an ahistorical category, but embedded within history and only understandable in terms of other historical forces. So I'm thinking of the work of McCutcheon and Chittister and my old colleague Tim Fitzgerald. And moreover, that religion is peculiar to Western civilization. Now, I don't share this scepticism that there's no subject area or object of scholarship, and find it ironically Eurocentric in wishing to reserve religion as the prerogative of the West. In recognising the claim that religion can only be understood within the boundaries of culture and history, we do not need to completely share the culturalist scepticism that there is no subject area or object of scholarship. The issue is more complex than a choice between religion as a sui generis category outside of culture and close to history on the one hand, and religion as a manufactured academic discourse that constructs its field from diverse social or political elements on the other, in the service of a hegemonic liberal ideology. Now, to maintain that there is a legitimacy to the category religion does not entail a commitment to an ahistorical concept born of itself. While I would not wish to offer a definition of religion here, I take the term to refer par excellence to forms of human practice communally arrived at, which are constrained by a text or group of texts set aside and regarded as sacred. Using the term sacred does not thereby imply a reification of an area of human thought and activity, such as to make it beyond inquiry or analysis, but it is to recognise that human communities mark off certain temporal, spatial, interior and relational areas of life as having a semantic density in contrast to mundane transactional activities. Such areas are generally not idiosyncratic but determined by tradition and community. While not all locations of semantic density are religious, one thinks of Shakespeare's house at Stratford-on-Avon, you could argue is a location of semantic density, or the battlefield at Gettysburg and Naseby. I was at Naseby not too long ago, and there's a monument there to the people who died in the battle in the Civil War in the 17th century, and people have left flowers there, and there's pots of flowers with little inscriptions, you know, the birth of English democracy, one of them said, you know. So, I mean, obviously a place of semantic density, but religious or not, it's difficult to say. All religions, though, in the sense that I intend in these lectures, have texts as sacred, which is believed to mediate in some sense between the community and some transcendent source. The faith traditions of the world, which refer back to their life-forming and life-giving texts, are thus primary objects of religious studies. So, these lectures then will be an attempt to address some of these questions, and will attempt to understand religions in the context of the human sciences rather than the natural sciences. Religions cannot be reduced to a series of claims about the nature of the world, because they fulfil a much deeper existential function that drives human beings not only to answer or come to terms with the great disruptive questions of life, such as birth and particularly death, but also compels us to go beyond ourselves and to transcend the condition in which we dwell. Religions are not scientific propositions, but ways of life, ways of acting, ways of responding to the strange world in which we find ourselves. Ways of being in the world which certainly make claims upon people, but which primarily function to address questions of ultimate meaning at a bodily and temporal level, in which human beings make sense of their experience. Religions arguably cannot be reduced to propositions about the world. Some of the claims of religion sound absurd to modern ears, but religions continue to hold great power over millions of people and cannot be simply dismissed as irrational or deluded. The secularisation thesis developed in the Sociology of Religion, Steve Bruce, for example, in God Is Dead book in 2002, has proven not to be the case with the rise of literalist understandings of religion or fundamentalisms, and the new configurations of religion in spirituality and religious pluralism. Religions are expressions in action of human need and human striving to go beyond ourselves, in my view. We might call this impulse to meaning and transcendence the religious imperative, or the religious impulse, to the horror of my old colleague Tim Sterling. So the general orientation of these talks is to seek an account of the importance of religion in terms of what we might call the religious imperative expressed in religious action and speech, which above all, or prototypically, means certain kinds of reading or reception of text set aside as sacred. In the coming weeks, I shall examine the idea that religions are best understood as kinds of action that address the limits of human life and express a desire for meaning and transcendence. But we need to locate any such account in the context of contemporary intellectual debates, such as the critique of essentialism and the contemporary socio-political situation of globalization and environmental change. Religions offer narratives within which people act and lead meaningful lives, which attempt to negotiate and make sense of the great non-negotiable events of birth and death, which resist explanation and also respond to the utter strangeness of being here at all. Because of the central existential place of religion for millions of people, to understand religion we need not only to engage with internal accounts of religion, often referred to as theology, but also with social, scientific and humanistic accounts that deal with human meaning. Indeed, I wish to argue that we can only fully understand religions from a humanities perspective. And one of the most important ways of understanding religions is to see them firstly in terms of action, which expresses this what I would call the religious imperative, and secondly, as kinds of reading that allow the internalization of traditions in the lives of the communities of individuals. I'll be talking about that next week. The religious imperative takes form and is realized through specific acts, especially, I argue, acts of reading by communities of reception that have pre-commitments to particular transcendental ways of seeing the world. The problem of religion that these lectures will seek to address, therefore not primarily problems in the philosophy of religion, although those will be relevant, but a broader range of issues focused on religion and the politics of culture and the nature of human subjectivity. So I don't intend to describe different religions, but wish to present an idea or even theory of religious action in future weeks, drawing on examples religious subjectivity, drawing on examples and texts from a variety of traditions and illustrations. In so doing, I hope to draw on other subject areas such as art, politics, and culture. So anyway, that's the general aims of this series of lectures. A brief note on the background now. Now, the debate about religion can perhaps be encapsulated by three statements. Firstly, religion is politics by other means. Secondly, religion is nothing but the genes. And thirdly, religion is a response to life or mystery. And this is on the handout. These tend to be mutually exclusive, but not necessarily so. The first two claims are forms of reductionism, a cultural reductionism on the one hand, that says that the analysis of religion shows that it is really about power in human relationships, and eliminative reductionism, or materialist reductionism, on the other, that says that religion is really about ensuring the successful transmission of the genes through the generations. It's about gene protection. Both of these positions take the view that the claims of religion are false. On the other hand, the third view, that religion is a response to life, mystery, or the strangeness of the world, says that religions cannot be fully understood in terms of the two reductionisms, but are a fundamental human impulse towards understanding the strange world in which we find ourselves. And this last view is itself not a doctrine of any religion as such. Most would claim to have knowledge of the world through a revelation. Most of these religions then would claim to have knowledge of the world through a revelation from beyond the world. But this claim is to encapsulate a theme found in all, and it might even be regarded as a weak theological claim. Weak in the sense that it's not a theological claim as such, because it stands outside the boundaries of theological tradition. This is to claim that religion as a realm of human theory and practice is distinct from other fundamental human activities, such as politics. From other human activities such as politics and arts, but is intimately related to them. So it's a separate realm of discourse, but it is connected to these other realms of discourse. Furthermore, religion cannot be understood outside of human subjectivity and action, which expresses this religious imperative, or this drive towards transcendence. In the broad context of these positions, the aim of these lectures then is to present a general account of religious action as a response to life or mystery, which expresses the religious imperative or impulse, the impulse towards transcendent meaning that addresses the fundamental problems of being alive in the world. The prototypical religious action that responds to the mystery of the world is a kind of reading, I think, or reception of text, understood in very broad terms, not only inscribed by writing, but oral and visual as well. This is to present a nuanced understanding of religions that takes seriously both external explanations and internal self-descriptions. This means that acknowledging that religions are socio-cultural forms of life that provide people with a sense of identity, meaning, clarity, and place in the world, and which exist in close relationship to politics and art. 30 or 40 years ago, there was a sense that religion was in decline in the West and would inevitably die out with the rise of secularism, the development of science, and a general incredulity towards the claims of religion, which were seen as eccentric irrationalities. Now, while there's been a rapid decline in church attendance in some countries in Western Europe, particularly in the UK, elsewhere in the world, we have, on the contrary, an increase in religious activity and commitment of a kind that directly challenges secular modernity. The rise of highly political Islam, Hinduism, and Christianity bear witness to this. But neither has religion disappeared from those most secularized nations, and the impulse to religion can be seen in a multiplicity of groups and ideas that affect mainstream forms of life, economics and politics, from business employing New Age techniques, management techniques, to public debates about euthanasia, the environment, animal experiments, and genetic research. While religions can't be separated from cultures, they nevertheless lay claim to the world and present fundamental orientations to the world and responses to its strangeness. There is no religion outside of culture, and there are cultural forms and societies which are not religious. So that's the kind of background. And I'm now moving on to the meat of what I want to say today, which is about religion and reductionism. Now, in the end, I think that reductionist explanations of religion are found wanting. But we should not dismiss reductionism out of hand. We should dwell in the hesitation, as it were, that reductionism presents us with. This hesitation about accepting religious accounts of the world has been with us for a couple of hundred years. And the power of this paradigm, the power of the masters of suspicion, particularly Marx, Nietzsche and Freud, needs to be taken very seriously. It would be absurd to dismiss reductionist explanations entirely. And as John Bowker has pointed out, explanations must necessarily be reductionist to some extent. And there are many nuanced positions. But I do wish to point out some deep problems in recent reductionist propositions, presuppositions about the nature of religion. Two tendencies in recent years have sought to provide explanations of religion in terms of a naturalist or eliminative reductionism on the one hand and a cultural reductionism on the other. Eliminative reductionism primarily now refers to theories of cognition and evolutionary psychology, along with their philosophical justification. By cultural reductionism, I mean accounts that see religion only in terms of a politics of representation and the structures of power. On this view, religion is a disempowering hegemony caused by a false consciousness, to coin use Marx's term, that has served the interests of the rich and powerful. Both kinds of reductionism share an incredulity to religious truth claims and offer explanation and critique that are rigorously externalist in their explanation of religion and thoroughly materialist in their ontological and ethical pre-commitments. Some eliminative materialist accounts of religion, and of ritual in particular, are sophisticated and have predictive power. That specifiable patterns of cognitive processing result from frequency of transmission or performance of rituals, for example. So you perform a certain ritual over a certain period of time, and it has certain kinds of brain correspondences. I mean, now on such accounts, knowledge of how the brain works will show us why a cultural phenomenon exists and how it comes about. Culture and religion is governed by brain processes on this account, and neural networks that give rise to language. The argument goes that once we know how cognition and language work in general, we can then know how religious cognition and language work in particular. But that there should be neurological correlates to mental states and behaviours, in my view, is hardly surprising. And while cognitive mapping and the emphasis on language and cultural practice increases our knowledge, neither eliminative nor cultural reductionism, in my view, are sufficient in providing explanations of religion. The fact that there's a correlation between ritual practice and brain states doesn't establish a causal connection. Both eliminative and cultural reductionisms offer external accounts of religion through the location of a cause, the former in nature and the latter in the genealogy of cultural politics, and I would wish to argue that these positions are inadequate. Neither can provide a sufficient account of interiority and subjectivity formed by religions, and both must inevitably bypass traditional internal concerns and forms of reasoning that make claims upon the world and upon human experience. Although this cannot be developed here, religious studies needs to take very seriously, I think, traditional internal reasonings and ways of forming tradition-specific subjectivities. So I want to deal now with eliminative reductionism and then, if we have time, cultural reductionism. So eliminative reductionism. Science and technology that flows from it is the fundamental contemporary paradigm in which most of us live. It forms the parameters of globalized existence from our fishing fleet in Nova Scotia to a hotel in Bangalore. While science developed into a highly sophisticated degree in China and India before the rise of European science, it is European science developing over the last 500 years that now dominates the globe, a domination enabled by the development of technologies in a variety of fields, such as medicine, engineering, biology, and nanotechnology. Clearly, this domination was enabled not simply by the power of ideas themselves, but by 19th century European imperialism and its consequences. Now, of course, science has gone beyond the boundary of the West, but its origins, in its current form, along with the accompanying technologies, are in Europe, although mediated through Islamic scholarship in the beginning. While the meaning of science is a contested area, there is much debate about its nature in the philosophy of science. Science as a form of systematic, rational inquiry and control through accompanying technologies is fundamental to modern ways of living and thinking. Even those who deny or reject the domination of science cannot help but live within its boundary. Whether turning on a light or taking your kids to the dentist, we live within the boundaries of science and technology. The power of science in modernity is astonishing, and this power has led to scientists to make claims of explanation in all areas of human and cosmic life because of its success. Science now offers explanations of biological being through genetic research, and offers explanations of the vast universe through cosmology, and the now well-supported theory of the Big Bang. In offering explanations of who we are, how we came to be as we are, and how the universe came to be as it is, science, so it is claimed, has replaced religion in offering explanations of these areas. Indeed, in offering explanations of life and matter, some scientists claim to offer a refutation of religion. An accurate, rational, falsifiable account of the world shows religious explanations on this view to be mere irrational superstition. Indeed, the explanation of religion itself must be sought in science, such as cognitive or evolutionary psychology, rather than any supernatural force. But, in not recognizing internal or emic accounts, eliminative materialism does not take meaning and the self-interpretation of social actors seriously. While internal or emic accounts which make empirical claims about the world are open to scientific critique, metaphysical claims are not. So, certainly, if religions make empirical claims about the world, that's open to scientific critique, because science is concerned with empirical claims. But metaphysical claims are clearly not open to scientific critique, because they're not claims about the world as such. Now, let us look at what an explanatory model in the natural sciences looks like, and then we can consider some problems in its application to human cultural life. The scientific or limitative reductionist model has an objectivist view of truth in which an explanation is in accord with the way things really are. Many years ago, Karl Hempel, a famous philosopher of science, put forward a model of scientific explanation that I've discussed elsewhere, but which is worth looking at again. For Hempel, scientific explanation, that he initially referred to as deductive nominological explanations, a horrible phrase, comprises a set of statements, the explanans, which explains another set of statements which is to be explained, the explanandum. This is also called the covering law model, the idea that an event is explained when it is deduced from a general law or set of conditions, and so the law covers that event, or the explanans sentences covers the explanandum sentence. Although the later Hempel developed an inductive probabilistic model, the covering law model attempts to be deductive, that the explanandum sentence follows deductively from the explanans sentence, i.e. necessarily. Hempel cites the example of Perrier's experiment that a length of mercury column in a Torricelli apparatus, exerted upon the mercury below equals the pressure on the surface of the mercury in an open vessel by the air above it. Therefore, the mercury column during an ascent becomes shorter. So that is, the pressure of the air determines the level of mercury in the glass tube. So Perrier was Pascal's brother-in-law, and Torricelli, about, I don't know, 50 years earlier, had discovered that if you get columns of mercury and you put them in, you'll know more about this, you put them in a mercury tub, the pressure of the air upon the mercury determines the length of mercury in the tube. Provided it's closed at the top. And Perrier was Pascal's brother-in-law, and Pascal phoned him up one day and said, discussed Torricelli's experiment, and so Perrier repeated it by going up the Puy de Dôme, I think, the mountain in central France and discovered exactly the same thing, and then repeated the experiment the next day through going up the top of the tower. So anyway, it's just an interesting aside, but Hempel uses this as an example as this kind of deductive nominological model. So the explanation, i.e. how you account for the mercury going up and down concerning the air pressure on the mercury, that's an explanation that follows deductively from the description of what's happening, i.e. Perrier going up the mountain and the description of the experiment. So the explanation is a deductive argument. The conclusion, the shortening of the mercury column, is deductive from general laws such as the pressure on the mercury column and assertion about relevant facts, namely that Perrier carried the apparatus to the top of the mountain. General predictive laws, L1, 2 and LR in Hempel's model, along with the particular facts, C1, C2, so on, result in a certain phenomenon. The predictive law and facts are the specification of operational constraints. The explanandum sentence is reduced or explained by the explanand sentences, and Hempel diagrammatically represents this in the following thing, which you've got on the handout. So you've got they're the explanand sentences, the general predictive laws, and then you've got the facts, the general predictive laws, such as the pressure of air on the mercury, and the facts about Perrier hoiking the apparatus up the mountain.
The operational laws and the predictive facts, and then resulting in the explanandum sentence.
But while this model may work for the natural sciences, there are problems in its application to human behaviour, because no deduction could establish a connection between the general laws of the explanand sentence and the human behaviour of the explanandum sentence within the human cultural world. Thus, for example, a girl offers a flower to Krishna as an explanandum is an explanandum sentence that might be accounted for by the explanand sentences, such as the girl has been raised a Hindu, offerings are regularly made to Lord Krishna at this time on this occasion, the girl is from an observant Vaishnava family, the girl is acting rationally within her worldview to attain a blessing, or whatever. All these are possible explanand sentences. These are all explanand sentences, or the specification of constraints upon the explanandum sentence. But there's no necessary entailment between these explanand sentences and the explanandum, as there is in the mercury example. There's no deductive entailment. Although Hempel did attempt to account for human behaviour in terms of reason, beliefs and desires in his later work, the hard form of nominological deductivism does not work for culture and therefore does not work for religion. I do not wish to dismiss Hempel lightly, as he is an extremely important figure in the philosophy of science, but I do wish to point to problems in reductionist explanations of what Bowman has called the old logic of the social sciences. Arguably, we have to live with indeterminacy, with the indeterminacy of what Bowman calls the new logic of the social sciences, the new logic of post-empiricism, what he calls post-empiricism. These issues are well rehearsed in philosophy of social science, but I wish here simply to point out the difficulty in adopting a model from the natural sciences when applied to the human sciences. I think this is the fundamental problem with explanations of religion, such as Pascal Boyer's interesting book on explaining religion, who seeks to account for religion in terms of cognition. One of the most important recent developments of this kind of reductionism is that religion can be explained in terms of evolutionary biology, that genetics can explain why we are religious, and that religious positions are simply errors, and often dangerous errors at that. But the scientists are not united, and while some are avowed atheists intent on debunking the superstition of religion, others are committed to a religious perspective. Indeed, a religious counter-argument might accept, for example, evolutionary biology, but would reject this as an explanatory account of religion. It might explain how living beings are in the world as they are, or specify a particular range of constraints, but it does not explain why beings are in the world,
the meaning of being in the world, or the mystery of life itself. So there's a whole trajectory of that from the early sociobiologists in the 70s of Wilson and so on, right the way through to our own Richard Dawkins. And there's some interesting work in anthropology on cognition by Scott Atran and various other people, and indeed Harvey Whitehouse here in Oxford. The second kind of reductionism, then the cultural reduction, I don't think, so my point is that eliminative reductionism does not work when applied to human behaviour. Secondly, cultural reductionism. The second kind of reductionism, cultural reductionism, is similarly problematic. Intellectuals in secular modernity, its contemporary culture despisers, have perhaps been surprised at the persistence of religion and now recognise its importance, particularly in the wake of religiously inspired bombings and the presence of religion in culture and international politics. Whereas 30 years ago, secular modernity might have thought religion to be nonsense, it is now considered to be dangerous nonsense. Religion is a political force in the modern world, and some analysts would see it purely in these terms. On this view, the discourse of religion covers a discourse about power in a community or nation. The implicit secularist critique, which sees itself as emancipatory critique, it's important because it sees itself as freeing people from this bondage that strives for social justice and human rights, is that once the conditions that give rise to religion are unveiled by criticism, religion dissolves. Behind this critique is the Marxist dictum that religion is the opium of the people, and to realise our freedom we need to give up this opium, to accept responsibility, and to stop being enthralled to some higher power expressed through hierarchical institutions. The secular modernist might think that religion is against the human good, and once religion is dissolved through uncovering the conditions of its production, then we can move forward through reason to more realistic, achievable human goods. The counterposition from the religious perspective is that, on the contrary, secular modernity leads to social breakdown, moral chaos, and a fragmented sense of self and suffering. And Rowan Williams's book of about 5 years ago, Lost Icons, is a good example of that kind of thinking. A religious worldview leads to human flourishing and the collective good of a people on that view. Now, part of the problem is, in all this, is what do we mean by an explanation? What is an explanation? I'm not making judgments about those kinds of reductionism right now, but what do we mean by an explanation? So what is it to give an explanation? There are, of course, long and complex historical trajectories from the Enlightenment that have led to the explanation of religion, closely linked to scepticism towards religious claims. On reductionist accounts, to explain religion is to locate a cause. So I think that's a basic fundamental reductionist understanding of explanation, is the location of a cause. And reductionist explanations seek to locate the cause in cognition, genetics, socio-political structures, or whatever. And to explain religion is to present an external account of it, often antithetical to the internal claims of the tradition. This understanding of explanation has been the predominant model in the natural sciences from Bacon through to the social sciences of our own time. Even theology, traditionally understood, claimed to explain religion in this way, as locating the cause of religion in God. By contrast, scientific explanations have been antithetical to religion in locating the cause of religion in nature, and claiming a superiority to theological accounts, because unlike such accounts, they are falsifiable and have predictive power. Both eliminative and cultural reductionisms offer external accounts of religion through the location of a cause, the former in nature, the latter in the genealogy of politics and culture, and so do not engage seriously with tradition's claims and concerns. And I've briefly tried to show this in a diagram that I've got on the bottom of that sheet. I don't like these summaries too much, but anyway, you've got three possible theology, science, and cultural discourse, and you've got the cause of religion, God in theology, arguably, function of religion, redemption. Don't know, you can fill in the gaps. for science, you've got the cause of origins of materialist processes and the functionist gene protection, arguably, in some cognitive, in some evolutionary biological ways of thinking. And for the culturalist, you've got power as a cause of religion and the maintenance of the status quo. And you could argue that this is very tentative, and a sort of dialogical comparative religion. Is the cause of religion a religious imperative in human beings? And arguably, the function of religion is to give meaning, provide meaning. But I'll be coming on to that next week. There is, however, a different sense of explanation that's not the location of a cause. And this is to draw or return to the explanation in the history of social science as understanding, and to claim that the explanation of religion is the exposition of a meaning rather than the location of a cause. To explain religion is not to seek a causal account in the first instance, but to show how something is connected to a broader sphere or context, and to demonstrate or translate a tradition's semantic density into a language which is implicitly comparative. This kind of account is both descriptive and interpretative in drawing out the implications of description in theory-informed, semiotically sophisticated ways, and reasoning within the horizon of the Western Academy. It is akin to phenomenology in wishing to offer thick description, yet like hermeneutics in wishing to inquire beyond description. Unlike eliminative reductionism, it must recognize the autonomy of higher-level processes in any hierarchy of multiple levels of organized systems. And unlike postmodern cultural constructivists, it must recognize the legitimacy of tradition and tradition internal concerns. It is far from clear that this kind of endeavor has had its day, and it also provides a way forward in avoiding the problem of the inadequate choice between universalism and area-specific study. So I would argue that religion cannot be exhaustively explained by the hard or social sciences. And a corollary to this is that religion cannot function as an explanation of the world in a way akin to science. To critique religion on the basis of its propositions is to fundamentally misunderstand the nature of the religious imperative. Rather, in ways that have already been indicated and ways which will be developed, religion must primarily be understood in terms of action and speech, which are the formation of meaning, and in terms of the human reach for transcending the boundaries of the strange world wherein we find ourselves. I'm going to skip on to my conclusion because we don't have time for much more. There's a lot of it, I'm afraid. So, kinds of reasoning. Then I think that there are different kinds of reasoning. So I would claim then that there's a legitimacy to internal accounts of religion. I haven't got time to go over the details of all this, or the argument for it. But by claiming legitimacy to traditions' accounts of themselves with reference to their central texts, as I would wish to do, and also be doing that next week, that's not a commitment to a reification of religion. Although it is a commitment to a truly pluralistic field of inquiry in which the theological expression of traditions has a place alongside the social scientific study of religions. We must inevitably accept a historicism that traditions change through time, constantly reinventing themselves in new contexts. You know, you find some practice in the Anglican Church that you actually find it's only about a generation old or something like that. You know, religions are constantly reinventing themselves. We can see this in the defense. So they reinvent themselves in new contexts and provide justifications in the face of external critique, which is what traditions do, as they should do. We can see this in the defense against both historicism and naturalist reductionism in Christianity, for example, during the 19th century, and the initial resistance to Strauss's historicizing of Jesus, and in resistance to Darwinian natural selection. These resistances, of course, are still present. But claiming legitimacy to tradition's self-representations does not thereby mean that religious studies as a field of inquiry gives uncritical hospitality. It cannot be simply a plurality of theologies because of the importance of and explanatory power of the social sciences, and it can and should offer corrective readings to traditions. While sympathetic to tradition's self-descriptions, these are not necessarily to be left unchallenged by external critique, either from text historical or philological perspectives concerning the composition and derivation of texts, or from socio-political perspectives such as feminism. Indeed, while Dimpley is deeply sympathetic to tradition internal concerns, religious studies can offer corrective readings to traditions and reflexively offer corrective readings to the science of religion itself, particularly in its eliminative and cultural reductionist forms. Because of this, religious studies cannot be a discipline united by a shared method, but is rather a field of inquiry with a shared object, however complex that object is. Now, one way of understanding religious studies, I think, is to look at it in terms of levels of discourse, or orders of discourse, or forms of reasoning. So we might say that the first form of reasoning is religion itself, the tradition itself. Then you get a second level of discourse, which is reflection upon tradition, from within tradition, and a third level of discourse, which is reflection upon the reflection, really. And a third order discourse is a form of reasoning about the first and second order discourses, which is implicitly, if not explicitly, comparative. And above all, this refers to forms of secular reasoning, disciplines, methods, and methodologies developed within the Western Academy. And religious studies, I think, is primarily a third-order discourse, or series of third-order discourses, such as sociology, religion, philosophy, religion, Indology, phenomenology, religion, and so on. So now these other kinds of discourse, which I haven't had time to go into, is the degree to which traditional theologies accept forms of secular reasoning that determine their degree of participation in the academy. So these first two forms, theology, is the degree to which theology and internal intellectual formation within traditions, the degree to which that accepts or conforms to secular reasoning determines the degree of the participation of those discourses in the Western Academy. Although there can be a blurring of distinctions between second and third order forms of reasoning, generally speaking, the Academy is broad enough to absorb within it some kinds of second order reflection. And clearly, Christian theology has taken on board secular reasoning and fights its battles within the framework of rational analysis. Something called scriptural reasoning, which was developed in the States by Peter Oakes and also in Cambridge, might also be seen as a model for interaction between second and order discourses from different religions, and in that activity creating a third order discourse, a discourse giving hospitality traditions, which they call the tent of meeting, and given hospitality within the secular academy. Difficulties come when the question arises as to which kinds of tradition-based reasoning can be accepted and funded, and we have witnessed conflict over integration of Jewish, Muslim, Christian, and even Hindu theologies within academic institutions. My own view would be that religious studies can offer a space in which different forms of reasoning and reflection upon texts and practices can develop within a horizon of expectation that no areas of tradition can be placed outside of method as developed within the secular academy. Religious studies, in spite of postmodernity's rejection of meta-theory, can therefore provide a meta-discourse about traditions, be comparative, and even offer theories about self and world, as is the case with some of the reductionisms discussed above. As in philosophy, economics, literary studies, and so on, scholars within religious studies, given the vast knowledge now available to them, can offer accounts of what it is to be human and offer accounts of the nature of the world, as has been done in the critical theory of religion, feminist critique of religion, and cognitive study of religion. Indeed, religious studies as a broad area of inquiry or series of third-order reasonings has great potential to offer in terms of developing theory, pursuing questions beyond mere description, exploring ontological questions, and contributing to human understandings and the human good. Now, by way of summary then, I've tried to indicate today it's been very broad. Thank you for your attention to some of that fairly complex material. There are problems with reductionist studies of religion. The eliminative reductionism and cultural reductionism don't work, in my view, because they're based on an understanding of explanation, which is the location of a cause. I think that religious studies offers a way of understanding religions, which is not the location of a cause, but is the exposition of a meaning and the relation of a meaning to a broader context, and the recognition of the fundamental human drive to meaning, and indeed arguably a drive to transcendence. Now, if that's a theological claim, I'm not sure that it is. It's a very weak theological claim, because it's not within any particular theological tradition of inquiry. But all this is still very tentative, and I haven't haven't made up my mind about a lot of this yet. So, we've got about 15 minutes for discussion and questions. Over to you. Go, Paul.
There's a very interesting book by Bucknell where he argues that the title of the book is At the Origins of Modern Atheism, and in that he argues that giving religion a rational basis, not only is it incorrect, but in addition to that, it was the cause to the rise of modern atheism in the 20th century.
Mm.
And of course, he wasn't the first to argue it. Hume and Bishop Berkeley, they all warned that, you know, giving religion a rational basis based on reasoning would inevitably lead to atheism.
Mm.
And I'm just wondering what you...
I don't know Buckley. I've met him. Buckley's book. I don't know it.
Buckley. Yes, sorry, it's
Buckley. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think that's. I think. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the claims of religion, like the Trinity, is. I mean, there's some kind of rationality to it, I suppose, but it's awfully difficult to comprehend. It's paradoxical.
Mm.
Three in one and one in three. That's a doctrine of religion, doctrine of Christianity, which is not open to empirical investigation. There's no empirical inquiry that could establish the truth or falsity of that. So it's a metaphysical claim, but so it's irrational. Yeah, and I think. Yeah.
There's a sort of internal rationality in terms of church history and councils.
Oh yes, that's true.
An internal theological rationality as to why
yes.
it had to be so.
Yes, that's true.
Given various other bits and pieces of the jigsaw.
Yes.
But that's how the jigsaw looked if you fitted it all together.
Yes, you can see, you can make sense of it, how it's arrived at historically.
Where you're coming from, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, pretty much. Mm-hmm. It's always been completely incomprehensible to me anyway, 3, 1, 1, 3.
Just following from that, is it really then the birth of reasoning that's going to lead towards atheism, or just empiricism? Because based on what you just said in terms of the internal rationality, all scholastic thought is rational.
Mm.
It just starts from certain premises
yeah.
which are not going to be accepted by, as you mentioned, Bradley, Hume, or the empiricist.
Yeah, so the step in McIntyre, there's three different versions of moral inquiry. So you have logic and reasoning. It depends on where you start, where you come from, where your presuppositions are. If you based on certain sort of religious presuppositions or whatever, then it's not irrational, but it just means that your reasoning is within the boundaries of these constraints, these traditions. And secular reasoning is like that too. But the trouble is, very often secularists don't recognize that it's a tradition of inquiry that they're in, that they have also presuppositions. Equally as problematic to Catholic presuppositions or whatever, Hindu presuppositions. So I'm kind of advocating kind of pluralism, but I'm arguing that there is that religion. You have to primarily understand religion not in causal terms, but in terms of meanings for communities. And in terms of people wishing to go beyond their limitations.
On the whole, I think I agree with most of your arguments and probably all of your conclusions. But there were various things that I starred on the way through. I was rather surprised that you defined religion in terms of texts, as if there were no religion outside texts.
I thought that would be quite a
lot. Yes. But the second thing, the rather more important thing is that to me, is that I'm very suspicious of this argument about reductionism. Because I am perfectly happy to accept a causal definition of religion as it is, either as biopolitics or as about genetic. It doesn't seem to me that that reduces it at all, in the same sort of way that I'm quite happy to believe that the dawn is actually the result of rotation of the earth. But I mean, that doesn't stop me from thinking that a dawn is actually rather a wonderful thing.
And the sun does rise.
And the sun does rise, that's right. So I think that there's a lot of quite unwarranted religious reaction to being told that religion in the human frame can be explained. Because actually, religion isn't about explanation at all anyway. It's about exploration and wonder and all sorts of things, which as a matter of fact, of course, so is science. But then perhaps religion has got to teach science that. So there were various places where I thought, remove the word only, and you and I would agree. But
right, okay,
if you keep the word only, then you have to argue that reductionism is wrong. And I have to say that your statement that reduction is wrong is wrong, because it shouldn't have the word only in it.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that, actually. There were two things there. One is the religion as text thing. That's a big topic. But yeah, I think that prototypically religions are constrained by text, and it's the bringing to life in the present in a present orality, if you like, a voice from the past and making it present for a community of reception.
You're omitting all the indigenous religions.
No, because you can talk about oral texts and visual texts.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I don't
want to restrict it to a book.
It's got a wider meaning.
Yeah, much broader meaning. Perhaps I'm using the term, perhaps I should look for a different word or something. But yeah, I mean, oral texts. Visual, and indeed, I would think visual text. I think a painting could be a text, even.
Rituals, dancing,
rituals. That's right.
Things,
that's
music.
Right. That's music. That's right. It's the enactment. It's the performance. The reception of the text. The songs that are sung, and so on.
And it's the sheer relationship with the nature in the animist religions, which would scorn any fixed text of any sort. Actually.
Right. Right.
But nevertheless, there's something running through it.
It's establishing some connection with the past and some anticipation of a future or something, but I think that there's been a welcome corrective, you know, to the textual study in archaeology and all this. Kevin Traynor and so on, Chopin, very important work. But I think they're missing something fundamental about religions. So the other thing you said about reductionism, I'm not anti-reductionist in particular, but I do think, partly anti-reductionist, but I think that that they're missing the point about religions. If you try to explain religions in terms of, purely in terms of cognition or evolutionary psychology.
You use the word purely to stand for only.
Yeah.
That's only the word that I'm objecting to.
Okay.
That religion can be perhaps completely explained as a result of genetic development. But that doesn't mean to say that we have finished it, talking about it and have explained it away.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah.
I've done some work on it. I might be interested.
Yeah, I would be interested. I would be interested in that. So you could have, I mean, I think you could have something that is as it is. Oh, I don't know. Say, human being, we're the product. We're the product of birth processes and so on. Our biology forms our bodies, but we're more than that as well. That's really what you're saying, I guess. Yeah. I think religions are like that too. It may be that we can talk about necessary conditions and sufficient conditions. That evolutionary biology or whatever, or neurology in a certain way, might be a necessary condition for the arising of religions, but not sufficient conditions. I quite like the idea of John Bowker's, the idea of constraint. He talks about, you can't talk about causation when discussing religions, but you can talk about constraint, and you have to say, what are the constraints operative that result in a particular specificity? What What are the constraints that what are the things that constrain an event into its outcome, into its particularity? And it's the specification of constraints that you need to emphasize. And in specifying those constraints, I wouldn't want to limit that specification to in terms of eliminative reductionism or cultural reductionism. But I think there are a wider body of you can specify constraints in a much broader field, and you have to, with regard to religious meanings.
I'm not sure if this would add to the conversation. I was reading Dennis Noble's The Music of Life, and he argues against upward causation, even in evolutionary genetics.
Ah.
And he talks about downward causation and interactive systems,
ah.
and how genes really do not have all the information, or they cannot be the cause of life,
right.
but it's the whole cell, and I mean, there's a whole argument there, even in natural sciences,
right.
which is kind of moving towards an anti-reductionist
approach. That's interesting. I'm not familiar with all this
literature.
Anti-cause
as well.
Yeah, anti-cause.
Particularly
subatomic. So, John Butler, is it Butler that, you know, a chicken is an egg's way of making another egg? Mm-hmm. Is that that argument? But it actually could be the other way around. So. Well, we have to wind up because it's midday. Well, thank you. I'm sorry about the mix-up with the time. Thank you for your attention, everybody.